This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hulu. Based on shocking true events, the new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, tells the story of a savage murder in a small town. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest this week is Tom Hanks. I mean, that's about all you need to hear, right? I mean, Sleepless in Seattle, Philadelphia, Saving Private Ryan, Joe versus the Volcano. Those are movies that Tom Hanks starred in. His newest film is A Man Called Otto, based on the book A Man Called Ove. Hanks plays the title character, Otto Anderson. When the movie starts, Otto is mourning the loss of his wife, Sonia. He's not sure how he'll move on with his life, or even whether he wants to live. A Man Called Otto revolves around Otto's relationship with his neighbors, specifically Marisol and Tommy. They just moved into the neighborhood with their two daughters. Despite Otto's demeanor, one that you might charitably call grouchy, Marisol and Tommy are determined to make friends with him. In this scene, they show up at Otto's door with a peace offering, some food.
Hi. We wanted to properly introduce ourselves because, you know, we're going to be neighbors and everything, so.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Bye.
Are you always this unfriendly?
I'm not unfriendly.
Okay, you're not. No. You're not unfriendly. Every word you say is like a warm cuddle.
Well, Tom Hanks, welcome to Bullseye. I'm happy to have you on the show.
Oh, great to be here.
It's nice to have you here.
I'm a first-time caller. Thanks for having me on.
Are you? Are there things that you are very grumpy about?
Turn signals? I mean, literally, put your blinker on, you know, the person in front of you. Or here's it is. You're coming up to an intersection, and a car is coming the opposite direction, and they're going slow, and they're going slow, and they're going slow, and they're stopping in the middle of the street. And you don't know why. It's because they're making a left turn.
Right.
And if they had just turned on their blinkers, I would have known what they were doing. And I would have understand why they were slowing down.
I feel like it's the I would have known. It's not when, for me, not when someone cuts you off.
No,
just
I understand
me
that.
Me being held in the liminal space between knowing what's going on and not knowing what's going on.
I can be in a car full of kids and I will unleash you, moron. Thank you for the use of the turn signal. Way to use your blinker, idiot. I mean, I go, and when I'm in the car,
you go full idiot.
Oh, when I go, when I'm in the car by myself, I use salty language.
Oh my gracious.
I use baseball dugout language. And you do not want to be, because it is, look, first of all, I was very good at driver's training. And the first thing you learn is drive defensively, make sure other people know what you're doing. Use your turn signal 100 feet before you get to where you're going. It's very, very basic. Tell me what you're doing. Because if I'm making a left turn or if I'm going straight and you're slowing down to stop in the middle of the – and I don't know why. I don't know why. So therefore, I can plow into you. You could T-bone me, anything. Can happen. But if you had just literally go – that's all I need. And then you go and I let you go. It all works out fine. Follow the frigging rules, you stupid moron. Give me your license. Give me your license right now. Roll down the window. Hey, roll down the window. I want the license and registration right now. You, sir, are not going to drive in my town again. I'm spilling my tea as I'm talking about it.
I want to be clear because our at-home radio and podcast audience can't see you.
No.
You literally just spilled your tea on the sofa here at the Four Seasons.
So sorry about that. So the answer is yes, I do have some of those kind of and that is it. Now, I've since made my peace with the technology that doesn't work. The menu, press, select, press, you know, I know that stuff is going to be screwed up all the time. But it's the powers of somebody else when they're behind the wheel if they don't know the basics of simple, courteous driving that sends me over the edge.
Amaya Colado is sort of about the ways that an accumulation of the pains and fears of life can lead to anger and sort of sadness and desperation. Do you have to choose not to get involved in that as you get older? Like, do you have to choose not to become a grumpy old man?
I think it isn't the trick kind of like saying, I don't have time to learn all this new stuff, because here's what used to happen. I used to just dial the phone and get the number. You know, you never had to like, thank you for calling. You know, even my own office now has, you don't dial in directly to somebody. You dial into a recording and then says press one and then hold for your option.
You don't have the direct line? I would think, let's get Tom Hanks a red phone in his home office.
Yes, Commissioner.
That he picks up.
No, it doesn't quite work that way. I think as one gets older, it's like, look, there's other ways to spend one's time as opposed to reading the manual on how to, you know, pair some new type of technology. Now, that's almost like, you know, look, I am a bit of a Luddite. I would probably rather type a letter on a typewriter than have to have a long protracted phone conversation. So I really only have one or two things to say to somebody, but that's not really the point. I think the point is that I got enough going on here. You know, if I have to actually go and study something in order to figure out how to do, one of the basic chores of one's daily life, I'll just do it the old fashioned way. Thanks very much. I don't.
We also live in a world where, or at least in a country that is like seized in paroxysms of, I'm not going to learn how to deal with new stuff. Like, we had an entire presidential administration based on people's discomfort with the idea that the world might be different from how it used to be.
Yeah, that's dumb. Here's the goofy thing. I actually think now I'm 66 years old. I remember the first Earth Day. And it became our responsibility to stop littering. It became our responsibility to start recycling. And not only was it good business, this was also really smart and made our cities cleaner. I think I'm of a generation that actually learned that, it comes down to personal responsibility. So I have to actually like make sure that I give everybody a fair shake and I have the correct change when I get on the bus and all sorts of these other small little things that you do in order to what? In order to make the world progress a little bit easier. So you can't be obstinate in the fact that I'm not going to learn anything new. Here's a pretty good example. Like, remember when e-readers were going to just wipe books off the face of the planet? I had an e-reader for a while, you know, and it worked fine. And I could get a book anytime I wanted to. And I could travel, with 42,000 books, you know, in a slim little volume, and I wouldn't have to carry them with me. But guess what? I read books in real time. So if I'm going away for 2 weeks, I can take two or three books, and I got everything covered. Doesn't take up that much space. So I think we're a bit of the generation that has learned that there is a quantity, but there is also a quality, too, that you can make a choice. What's the easiest and better way to get by it? You don't want to embrace what's ignorance just for the sake of making your life easier. You actually want to make an intelligent choice about what is kind of like good and what is unnecessary. Because there's an awful lot of people, there's also a lot of enterprises out there that are going to try to convince you that this is actually a great thing to have. And all you have to do is pay us $35, you know, and make sure you constantly renew it, and then your life will actually be better. No, it won't. What it will be is it'll be make your business profitable and won't really affect my life very much at all. So I might be of a generation that is judiciously choosing the stuff that is worthwhile and the stuff that's not.
I mean, I just want to go ahead and say, if anybody's listening to this, only $10 or $20 a month, you can become a member of your public radio station that you're listening to.
And
this
that's a good deal. I'm going to tell you right now. Okay, let's break that down. Okay, $10 or $20. I listen to public radio. I'm going to say probably somewhere between 1 hour a day and 17 hours a day, because sometimes I just leave it on all day. Well, that's a friggin' bargain right there. And it's a bargain in real time. I'm getting my money's worth every time I turn it on. If I was to pay $20 for a service that I never listened to or never subscribed to or never put on, guess what? I'm out 20 bucks. So it actually, that's a judicious choice that one's make in order to make one's life a little bit easier.
I will say that my colleague Kevin, who's sitting to my left, used to work at a local NPR affiliate station here in Los Angeles.
Which one? The one in Santa Monica or the one in Pasadena?
The one in Pasadena. And
bad blood between those two. Like the battle between Volvo and Saab. You got to decide which imported Swedish car you're going to root for, the one in Pasadena or the one in Santa Monica.
Probably. I do appreciate that your go-to example of a famous feud is Volvo versus
Saab.
Well,
you know, you could go, yeah. What
it is pretty public radio, unfortunately, or
is there that much
difference
between a Ford and a Chevy anymore? I will say this. There's one word that describes the difference between those two stations. Music. One has, one don't. And some people don't need music and some people got to have it.
Okay, let's talk about something else. Tom, what is an example of something that has been work for you to understand or adjust to as a grown-up adult, as a person over 40 or 50, let's say?
Oh, that's a myriad of things.
That was important. I mean, we're not talking about now you have to plug your car in.
Oh, no, that actually makes life a little easier because then the only time you're stopping at a gas station is for, you know, Slim Jims and to use the bathroom. I would say it is the battle against cynicism. You know, I think it's so much fun to rag on everybody because you're in competition with them when you're younger and you're competitive and you're a little bit on the selfish, and it's really, really fun in order to make yourself feel better by essentially ragging on somebody's efforts, not like it, whether it's good or bad, you know, celebrating their failures and then sort of like trying to examine somebody else's success. And I don't just mean in the business. I just mean, you know, across the board. I think as one gets older, I think you realize that cynicism gets you nowhere. Isolation gets you nowhere. Procrastination gets you nowhere. If you don't do it, who's going to do it? But I think the default position of an awful lot of society is saying, I don't think that's so great. What's so special about that? You know, why would anybody bother doing that? A lot of the media is based on, you know, exercises in hilarious cynicism. You know, everybody is doing something stupid and everything is worth ragging on. And I think that when you get older, you begin to appreciate effort for the sake of effort and authenticity for the sake of authenticity. I learned a while back from somebody who, you know, is quite accomplished that there is no joy in slagging on somebody's failure, that the best thing you could say is, well, you know, that if it didn't quite work, did it? That's the most honest appraisal you can say about anything, particularly any creative enterprise. Didn't quite work because as a storyteller and someone who is, look, this is my job, you know. Not only is it my job, it's my joy. When I started being a storyteller, vis-a-vis actor, you know, stage manager when I was younger, whatever it is, taking part in the ensemble effort in order to give people their solids worth of entertainment. Failing is just so painful, you know. Not getting there was just it rattled you. It made you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and think, "What did I do wrong that we lost them in the third act?" Or, "Why is it that I can't break story on this one thing? What is it about this role that is escaping me, that is scaring me, that I truly don't have any faith in my ability to do that?" Having gone through all of that, you realize that we're all just trying our best, man. There's so much. There's so many moments of serendipity that are beyond your control, and there's sometimes you just run out of wherewithal and instinct, and then you can only have faith in somebody else, and you can only have faith in somebody else in coming along and giving the catalyst that gets you along there, and that being willing to use is worth the battle. So I, as I'm at the age that I am now, I think I am 10 times less cynical I was at the age of 46 than I am at the age of 66, because I just know how hard it is. And I now appreciate people trying really hard and almost getting there. And even the ones that are kind of like, you know, didn't quite get there. The worst thing I could say about anybody is that didn't quite work, did it? Because I've been on the receiving end of, boy, that didn't work. And what can you do except bow your head down in humble submission? This is true. It did not work, but you only learn by your failures anyway. So embrace that and move on.
We've got so much more to get into with Tom Hanks. When we return, he started as a comedy actor, but he's won dozens of awards for his work in drama. I'll ask him whether making that transition was scary. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This message comes from Apple Card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase. That's 3% on products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card, issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval, terms apply.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Hulu. Dive into the chilling new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, the riveting adaptation of the acclaimed true crime book. Based on shocking true events, Under the Bridge tells the haunting story of a murder that lays bare a small community's darkest secrets. Go deep into the hidden world of the town's tormented teenagers as detectives race to solve the sinister crime. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu. This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy.
Parenting. It's hard, but don't worry. You're not alone. Belly up to the low bar with One Bad Mother and let us remind you that fine is good enough.
They want to climb on different things. And how am I supposed to keep them both from dying?
There is a right way to do this. And if I can figure out that right way, I'm going to be a good parent. So that is not a thing.
So join us each week and let us tell you that you are doing a good job. You can listen to One Bad Mother on Maximum Fun or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom Hanks. The Academy Award-winning actor is starring in the new movie, A Man Called Otto, which is out now in theaters. Let's get back into our conversation.
I sometimes think that had I not backed into a radio show where I had to put something on the radio every week since I was 19, I've been doing this show since I was 19.
Wow. Like,
since I was 19, every week I had an hour, and if I wasn't there, there could be an emergency broadcast alert, and it would be illegal for me to not be there to press the button or whatever.
Let me ask you a question. Was that deadline good for you?
Well, that's the thing. Like, I think that to me, and I wonder if it's the case for you, if I didn't have that requisite that I had to show up and I had to have something to put on the air, because it was worse to not have something on the air than, you know, ready to go, that I don't know if I could have done something and gotten better, because I was, and to some extent am, so paralyzed at the prospect of doing a bad job that maybe I wouldn't try.
This is what is terrorizing about what we do for a living. I mean, I try to put off saying yes to something as long as possible. Saying yes to say, okay, let's do this, means you are on, number one, you're on the clock. You start working from that very, from that moment. I mean, if you're not, even if you're not going to shoot something for 18 months, you start working right then and you begin the job for 18 months. Then comes the time where you actually have to go up and start. You have to start. I always want to throw up the first day before we start shooting, because as soon as we start, it's locked in stone. And maybe you can go back and replace it. Maybe it won't end up in the movie. But your address of it is now on the record. And if you don't have it, ooh la la, no one knows you more than you that you don't have it. And you might be able to fake people out. You know, you might be able to intimidate folks into buying what your goods are, but you yourself know what it is. So I actually, in some ways, envy like a newspaper columnist that has to put out a column, you know, like Herb Cain did when I was a kid, once a day, or someone who has to put together a 1-hour radio program, because I said, well, you know, man, he's got a week to figure this out, doesn't he? He's, you know, can't you do, I'll do this for 20 minutes and I'll do that for 20 minutes. But I get the pressure of the deadline. And have you ever said, okay, that's the show. And then the last thing you want to do is have to hear that show. Because I don't watch these movies a second time, because I see them once and they don't change, man. They don't become better with age.
I'll tell you this, though. I, years ago, did a show about interviewing, and I interviewed all these famous interviewers, some of whom were like my heroes, like Terry Gross and stuff. Mm. And I interviewed Larry King, and Larry King was not one of my heroes. I had no negative feelings particularly about Larry King, but very unexpectedly, I think I learned the most from talking to Larry King, who famously was ill-prepared for his interviews, let's say. Well. But also a guy, you know, he had a job where he had to, when he was on the radio, he was doing 4 hours a day. Yeah. You can't prepare for that,
really. Late night with Larry King, sure.
But like the thing that I learned from him that did not come naturally to me, that strikes me as something that is essential in acting as well, is that all the preparation in the world cannot prepare you for necessarily, and in fact, sometimes can stand in the way of presence. Mm-hmm. And like, you can't muscle your way through acting. Like, you have to be able to, like, look, there's preparation you can do to understand your character, understand what your character is trying to do in a scene, your character's goals, the body, you know, various things, right? But like, at the end of the day, effort isn't the difference.
You don't get credit for moxie, you know. There's no way you can suck it up, you know. Years ago, when I was in at the Great Lakes Shakespeare Festival in Cleveland, Ohio, I just couldn't believe I had the job. I couldn't believe that somehow someone said, I think you should be an actor and you should learn these lines. You should get undo it. We got yelled at by the director, Dan Sullivan, who's a very well-regarded director. Very famous. It was rotating repertory theater. I was in the intern class with a bunch of people that I'm still friends with. And the equity actors, the veterans that were up there, they had just opened a production of Hamlet the night before. And so they had an opening night party. And so many people were hungover and exhausted. And we were supposed to be rehearsing The Taming of the Shrew. And everybody was listless. Nobody was really trying hard, and it was hot, and it was, you know, it was Tuesday or Saturday or whatever it is, and 10 in the morning, and everybody is still living on their coffee, and, you know, no one is really there. And Dan Sullivan yelled at everybody. He said, you guys aren't here today. You don't understand, man. You guys got to show up on time, and you got to know the text, and you got to have an idea. Otherwise, I can't do anything with you. And I actually thought, oh, well, there's our responsibility right there. If you show up on time, because if you're late, you're gone, period, the end. They will not put up with you being late. This is one of the best lessons you could possibly learn. Late, that means you're not here at all. So bye-bye. Secondly, know the text. Now, that means know your dialogue, certainly. That's the minimum that you need to do. But you also have to know the text. You have to know the play. You have to know the story. You have to know the intent of what all of these scenes are. You need to know what your place is in it. But the last thing was you have to have an idea, and that's the great intangible. You don't have a future in the rehearsal process or the shooting process unless you have an idea in your head. Meaning, not one that you explain, not say, I really think I would like to have a chicken on my shoulder for the court. You know, you don't come in with that. When you come in with a euphemistic chicken on your shoulder that no one will see, that you just say, well, I'm actually playing this as though I have a chicken on my shoulder. And that's why I'm so interesting in this scene. Now, that's a stupid way in order to put forward this idea that unless I carry something around that is mine and mine alone, all I'm doing is saying the words and hitting the marks, which oddly enough in movies sometimes works just fine. But in order to have something bigger going on behind your eyes, you've got to have that idea inside yourself that no one knows and no one wrote down. It's yours and yours, yours alone. That gives me faith in whatever is going to come next. I think my job, I'm purely an actor. When I'm in there and I'm interpreting what the screenwriter put down on paper and what the director wants the scene to be like, I believe I can motivate anything because that's my job. And that's the idea that I carry around. So because a director can say, for whatever reasons, go to the window. Go and look out the window. I wouldn't go and look out the window. And the director says, well, if you don't go and look out the window, then I don't have any reason to cut away to Meryl Streep in the phone book, in the phone booth. I said, well, my job is to, okay, you need me to go to the window? Watch this. What I'm going to do when I go to the window is open it up so my chicken on my shoulder can get some air. that's why I can go. So motivating anything like that, that is that requirement. Now, that's not the same thing as having a deadline. It's actually having an open interpretation to anything that you can go anywhere that you need to. And it took me a really long time to figure that out. Some directors will say, would you go to the window? And my question is, would you like me to go to the, you know, there's all this kind of like stuff that whether or not you're part of a true ensemble collaboration, or if you're just in the hands of a dictator that says, here's what we're doing here right now. And the actor's job is to say, okay, all right, if that's what we're doing here, watch this. That's what I like to say. You need me to do this? Stand back. No one's going to do it better than I can. Now, that's cocky to some degree, but it also, man, it's been a long road in order to get to the place where I thought I can give the bosses what they want.
Was it scary to give up being funny? And I don't mean that you're not often funny performing now, but, you know, funniness is a great defense for a performer. And there have been times when you have been called on not to be funny. And I wonder if it was scary to let go of that.
No, it's sometimes a relief to not have to do a comedy because it's the hardest thing there is to do. Because sometimes it's simply not funny. The words as they are written are not funny. Now, it could be kooky and it could be marketed as a comedy. And believe me, I've made some comedies that are not funny because there is something that is untrue about what you're going for. I will tell you, I got hired in the business because I was loud and I was kind of funny. There was oftentimes I was the funniest dude in the room, partly because it's a self-defense mechanism and I was, you know, shirking an awful lot of responsibility. But when I was doing Bosom Buddies with Peter Scolari, Peas in a Pod, he and I spoke a secret language between us. Gestalt, a look, a shrug, a couple of words meant everything because we spent so much time together connected at the hip, making stuff that was either funny on itself or being tasked with the writers to say, hey, you know, spice the fups, guys, sprinkle some fairy dust on this for us. We had a phrase called boys chuffa off, which means scenes ended with me and Peter goofing around with each other. Just in order to make ourselves laugh, in order to get to the end of the scene. And there was a period of time where they tried to write our chuffa for us. And we said, guys, give us the freedom, please, to figure out what our own chuffa is. That pressure week after, we talk about a deadline, is be funny at the end of the week. That there was an awful lot of stuff that went into it. I'm going to tell you right now, if you're having a horrible day with, you know, your family or the dentist or bad news from anybody, and you got to come in and be funny with Peter Scolari and Hildy and Buffy, have to figure out how they're going to stay in the all-women's hotel. That could be really hard in order to make fly. The other thing that goes along with it is that a quote-unquote drama, I think, is really boring if it's only dramatic every step of the way. The great fun of all of this is to find real human behavior in certain circumstances. And people talk the way they talk, and they have their desires, no matter how serious as a heart attack something is going on inside a film. So inside a story. So it's not the task is always to deliver unto the audience that which is enshrined and carved in stone as far as the words on paper and the intent of the director goes. You have to be real. I don't want to, it's highfalutin to quote Spencer Tracy, but I think he once said, there's no trick to acting. You just hit the marks and tell the truth. And damn, if that ain't what it's required. And it's really hard to tell the truth sometimes when you haven't figured out what it is, or someone is asking for you to lie and make it faith in the first place, or if the truth isn't there in the words that you're supposed to talk about. But if you're in like-minded individuals, the collaboration in order to do that, everybody works and helping you hit the marks and tell the truth.
So your parents got divorced when you were very young. You live with your dad.
Well, for the first time.
Yeah.
They got divorced a lot.
You had a kind of, your dad had a kind of serial family situation for you. Like you have people who were your step siblings that you are like not in touch with and that is, that can either lead to just total alienation or a life where you make it a priority to engage with others and ingratiate yourself. But I can only imagine that it's tough when you go to 10 different schools or whatever it was and you're good at ingratiating yourself, which I presume you were, to do more than that, right?
I can seduce a room. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
When you became an actor, you're still young and you're funny enough and loud enough to get over on being charming, which is kind of a similar thing.
There's a danger to that. Yeah. Right.
And you're still in a mode where you're pretty externally focused, right? Like when you're being funny on a sitcom, you're making the audience laugh when you chuffa.
Well, yeah. And honestly, you also have to be funny on talk shows and stuff like that. And that's no less of a performance, but at the same time, it's, it's an instinctive one. So
at some point, like when you say making choice, when you say like, what do you want to do was the question your agent asked you, like other than make everyone else around me happy or comfortable,
right.
I kind of got the impression that that question had never occurred to you.
Oh, dear God, no, it hadn't. It's like, what opportunities are out there? Here's what you can do now. It's never like, what do you want to do? Is there a question in there?
Those are parallel things in your life to have to make that choice in your work and also in your life. Like, I want to have agency, not be responsive.
Right. That's a good way of putting it. Agency, purchase, I think, purposefulness. I don't want to waste anybody's time, and I don't want to do anything that is so false that the manipulative aspect of it is an obvious one. So being asked, what do you want to do? If I was going to have to parse out like an individual moment since then that I can say is, this is 100% of what I was going for, and it turned out the way I wanted it to turn out. It was when we sort of like had to fight in order to do this movie called Greyhound, which is nothing more than 48 hours at sea in the middle of the Atlantic, in the middle of World War II, with nobody knowing if they were going to make it or not. And I'm the captain of the ship.
Do I break radio silence with a message to the Admiralty? But does that let the Wolfpack know just how vulnerable we are?
What would the message be?
Help needed urgent.
Now help needed, that means urgent.
Needed isn't needed. Just help. That's all the Admiralty needs to hear for a modified rendezvous point.
Germans might miss a message as short as that.
I wouldn't need to take this risk if I'd been smarter yesterday.
What you did yesterday got us to today.
It's not enough, Charlie. Not nearly enough.
And it always came down to nothing that I said, no specific plot point that played itself out, no shot that demonstrated that the bad guys were out there and the good guys were over there, nothing. It came down to literally what's going on right now in Captain Ernie Krause when he honestly is asking himself, am I making the biggest mistake ever right now? That to me is the be-all and end-all of any sort of motion picture moment. It's when, and you could go back to light moments. You can go back to, you know, James Stewart and It's a Wonderful Life, Dear God, Help Me. Or you can go back to, you know, Danny Kaye, you know, in some movie like that. You can go back to any sort of place where nothing is said. There's no dialogue, and yet everybody who watches the movie knows exactly what is going on in that character. So that's high country, man. And I think I've come close and not landed there a bunch of other times. But this odd amalgamy, you know, of a bunch of stuff that comes into a moment where I thought I was just doing what the director said. But because I was doing what the director said in a beat that was very well thought out from a moment in a screenplay that was wrestled to it, so that was edited to the ninth degree, and then a very, very intricate musical score was added, and it's projected up on the wall with the right lumen count behind it, with the right amount of people in the audience, and everybody knew exactly what was going on in there. That's what you get from a motion picture. And it took me a long time to realize that that doesn't happen unless everybody gives 100% of going there. That's the high country. And I didn't realize that such a thing was possible. And I didn't realize how the responsibility that every actor has in it until, I don't know, 3.5 weeks ago. You know, I said not too long ago, I said I made 80 movies and 4 of them are pretty good. And everybody says, ooh, Tom Hanks hates, you know, 76 of his movies. I said, no, there's no room for self-deprecating humor in any of this. The fact is, I don't know if it's any good or not, you know. I can only go by, you know, I've seen all the movies once and they never change. And I'm either satisfied or not, but I don't know if they're any good. And I don't know if, you know, I don't know if I got there or not. It's for somebody else to figure out, somebody else to say.
We got to go for a quick break, but when we return, we will finish up my interview with Tom Hanks. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MassMutual. According to Calendar.com, the average person schedules just 4.5 hours per year on finances. MassMutual gets it. Life is busy. If you can't find time to plan your financial future, find someone who can, like a MassMutual financial professional. For the last 170 years, they've helped people plan for retirement, college tuition, and any other short or long-term financial goals. Learn more at MassMutual.com. Support for NPR and the following message come from the American Cancer Society. Dr. Alpa Patel leads a team that researches cancer risk factors, and she shares how her team makes an impact.
We always do what we like to think of as actionable science. So the work that we do makes its way to things like nutrition and physical activity guidelines for cancer.org, where millions of people come each year to learn about how they can better prevent cancer.
To learn more, go to cancer.org.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom Hanks. You might know him as one of the world's greatest movie stars. His new film is A Man Called Otto. It's in theaters now. Here's the rest of our conversation. Let me ask you this. You had been through all these family formations and schools and houses as a kid.
And I sort of loved it.
You were... Well, we can talk about that in a minute.
The rest of the family didn't care too much about it.
But, that worries me, Tom, but we'll return to it. You know, you were married, had kids, and divorced when you were young. And, you know, you were obviously great at being ingratiating.
Mm-hmm.
Like, loved it enough to make it your career. You're funny and so on and so forth. But it took until you're in your mid-30s before you have this idea of I should make a choice for myself.
Right.
Did you have a hard time as a young man? You know, acting's transitory too. Like, you have these really intense relationships with people over the 2 months that a show plays or a movie.
I live life getting really close to people and then never seeing them again.
Yeah. So did you have a hard time having the kind of sustained intimacy with others or yourself that's required to, like, make real choices that have lasting impact and make art?
First of all, go screw yourself with these important questions that are going to get to the bottom of my psyche. But no,
you listen to public radio 17 hours a day. You know what I'm here to do.
Yeah, for 20 bucks a year. Mm-hmm.
Usually you have to pay somebody
for this. You have landed on something that can be one of the great crutches of doing what I do for a living, is that it's transitory. You know, I get to pick up and take off. It's all done. Away we go. And the most we'll have from it is some sort of memory. You know, you mentioned that, my dad was married to a very nice lady and she had 5 great kids and we lived together for about 2.5 years. And my memory of it is sort of like, well, I went to school with them for a while. You know, then we grew up, we went on our separate ways. I remember the important lessons and I remember the secure times pretty well. There was a lot of good laughs. But there was also a huge amount of confusion that went along with it. Like, I was the youngest of 8 kids. And how did I end up here? And well, somebody please explain to me why we are moving again. And no one ever seemed to explain to me. And what came about from that is not long after that, we started riding the bus a lot, going between my dad's house and my mom's house. And what it was is every holiday we'd be put on a bus. And there were 3 of us, and so my brother and sister often sat together, and so I was the 3rd one out. So I always sat next to a window, and some stranger sat next to me, and sometimes those strangers were benign, sometimes they were cheerful, sometimes they were malevolent, and sometimes they were scary. But what I always had was the vista of the window in order to look out and daydream. And going off into other scenarios, storytelling in my own head was a very, very powerful analgesic, if I'm using the word analgesic properly. I developed, I think, really quickly a comfort of being alone and enmeshed in a story of my own making. And it was all based on, you know, popular imagery. You know, I was a hero. I was a fireman. I was an astronaut. I was a member of the Fantastic Four, or I was a confused little boy who was being taken care of by benevolent, grownups.
It doesn't seem like a coincidence that 60% of your most famous roles are you being one of those things and also being terrified.
Well, there might be a reason that I'm drawn towards things like Castaway.
You're always like the horrified captain of a boat, you're a regular hero thing, but also struggling with being terrified.
I think that at the age of 66, I realized that a little bit a while ago.
But could you like sit with yourself without being in a fantastical world? Like, at what point were you able to sit with yourself and be with yourself rather than
that's a very good question. And I'm going to say that somewhere in the last 10 years or so, when I started I have a company. It's called Playtone, and we produce all kinds of stuff. I had an idea for a screenplay that was mine and mine alone, and I ended up writing it. Now, never mind. We made the movie, and I was in it, and we directed. It's called That Thing You Do.
The Wonders are in breach of contract.
Sorry. I'm really sorry, Mr. White.
Well, don't worry. No one's going to prison, son. It's a very common tale.
Well, maybe for you, but I was in a band and we still have a hit record.
Yeah, you do. One hit wonders. It's a very common tale.
My first time in a real recording studio.
You want to hang around for a while? Okay by me. But you're out of the hotel this afternoon. Can't help that. You know, Guy, Horace was right about you. You are the smart one. Lenny is the fool. Jimmy is the talent. Faye is... Well, Faye is special, isn't she?
I started writing it, and I got to the end of it. And that was the first time I did something all on my own that I did not share with anybody and was not relying on somebody else to come in and impact. Later on, we made the movie. Of course, we did. But when I was actually writing a story, that was a proactive, creative desire that didn't require anybody else inviting me into the process. And somewhere around in there, can I call it discipline? A discipline and an understanding of the solitary effort became something other than solitude, if that makes sense. So much of a life as an actor is waiting to be invited to go to the circus, waiting to join the gang and put on a show. At the beginning of that, when I ended up becoming a screenwriter first and then a different kind of writer later on, that's when I think I just calmed down, settled down, and stopped trying to seduce the room on charm. And instead just said, I have this idea that I'm going to do the hard and heavy work. Eric Roth, who is a good friend of mine, he's a great screenwriter, and other writers that I've since become friends with, you know, and they talk about writing. I said, they say, you know, it's a solitary existence. You do. You sit in a room and you think, well, here's just a person in the room. And that sounds like a sentence. No, it's not, because your head is so filled with this big, massive thing. And not to become overly poetic, but I was going to make the connection. It's not unlike when I said, and I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed those 4-hour bus rides of looking out the window and daydreaming, because the quality of the stories that I saw inside my own head were vast expanses for me. They were much, much bigger than being a confused 9-year-old kid on a Greyhound bus. Instead, I was as big as any story that Shakespeare could have written.
What about being married? Like, you've been married to your wife for a long time now, and
34 years, 35 in April.
When you're married 35 years with children, you're raising children together, like, you have to sit comfortably in family intimacy that you're hoping will last the rest of your life. I ask you this mostly because it was not comfortable for me. I've been with my wife since we were 17. It's still once in a while. Wow. I'm like, what am I doing?
Well, sure. Yeah.
But
you didn't wear that?
Did you? but like, you must have been forced into a position where you couldn't be transitory. Like, it must have been learning to
well,
you.
Well, yeah, that's actually, my son Colin is just turned 45. And honestly, him being born was the greatest thing that could have happened to a guy who was as big a dumb a cluck as I was, because I just would have been cast at sea. I just would have been a guy that would have done anything, would have tried any, you know, bad habit, would have developed any vice, would have skipped out on all responsibility. I would just try to entertain myself and seduce everybody who was there. But when you have this thing that this little boy that is this kind of miraculous kind of like creature that is both familiar and a mystery all at the same time, it required me to you know, I'd not say I buckled down. You can ask all my kids and they'll tell you our dad is the biggest chucklehead on the planet. Sometimes he's not there at all. But knowing that there was something that it was, I had to admit, look, this is my responsibility. I don't know how to do this right, but I know how to approach it and try to learn what goes along with it. So when you end up having kids at an early age and you want to see them every day, which is the case with all my kids, I would like to have breakfast with them all every single, you know, I might just listen to them. And by the way, they might beat the living daylights out of me at the same time. And they might also tear me apart for all my faults, but they're not going to be wrong. You know, you know, that's going to be what their opinions are. And it ends up being the thing that I'll say that it gave me a degree of focus, because as an actor, I knew that I had bills to pay. I had to pay the rent. I had to, you know, I had clothes and food and doctor's bills that, you know, my kids needed to be. So I ended up doing jobs without even thinking about it, just because they gave me the opportunity to it. And it ended up being one of the greatest training grounds possible.
But you also can't be glib in a, you know, long-term intimate relationship in the way that you can when you step into a room to pitch a sitcom whatever.
You can't. No, but you can be stupid. I mean, you can make all sorts of decisions, and you can be, you know, you can make yourself fraught with being, you know, too self-serving or too much in the moment. And I have to say that when it comes down to powers of skills and empathy, you know, I got to work on that stuff all the time, because I did stuff by myself for so long. You know, sort of it's like, hey, dude, get on the bus, man. Otherwise, you're not going to go up to mom's house. So stop complaining and get along with it. That's not the best thing for, that's not the best lesson for a kid to learn. And it's not great stuff in order to pass on to your own kids as well.
Did you have to understand that you could admire your parents or like your parents, things about your parents, while also seeing that kind of, you know, my therapist would call it neglect. I'm not going to say I relate to this, but
when I transposed my parents' life at, say, at the age of 36 to my own life at the age of 36, I didn't have a clue. I was just beginning to figure things out. I'm going to cut my parents the same slack.
Okay, right. But the question is, I can tell that you cut people slack. At the bare minimum, you're going to tell me that you cut people slack, but I sincerely believe that you're cutting your parents slack.
Oh yeah.
Well, like, was it hard for you to get to the point where you could engage with the problems of that childhood that you told me was wonderful already earlier on?
No, I said I liked it. I didn't say it was wonderful. I said, and by saying I liked it, I think I liked the variety. You know, I will tell you that in various incarnations, I came home to a house that was not the most welcoming place in the world. Not because of any sort of malevolence, just because everybody was so much involved in their own self-drama, they didn't have room for anybody else's needs. And that's not a great thing to realize when you're 11 years old. All right? The great love of my father's life, my dad passed away, I'm going to say 30 years ago. But the great love of his life, my stepmother, his third wife, passed away just earlier this year. And I got together with my former step-siblings. And we ended up talking about how truly horacious a job these people did when they first got married, along with the incredible job they did with us afterwards, because they ended up saving my life a couple of times. And they were so gracious, and they were so forgiving, and they understood exactly what they had done wrong, and they did not feel good about it. But they were also incredibly open. I'm going to tell you, at various grandparents' days, both my real mom, my birth mom, and my stepmother would come to grandparents' days to my kids' schools, and they would sit together. The idea of my mom and my stepmom sitting together was an impossibility for a vast chunk of my childhood, so much so that I said, hey, it's a good thing Dad's dead, because if he saw this, this would kill him, seeing you guys sitting. And they laughed. And the wisdom of time that goes by, and the acknowledgement that we did not do everything right, and there's no excuse for it, there's no defense for it, and you can't even say, hey, I did the best I could, because even that's mealy-mouthed. All you can do is bow your head and say, yes, that's what the truth was. So when I say I cut my parents slack, I think I did it in the way any kid would to, I know a couple of people who said I would not trade my childhood for anything. It was fabulous. And I just want to say, well, your last name is not spelled H-A-N-K-S, because there's a lot of stuff that we would trade off. But what are you going to do? You know, you can't change what it is. And I've weighed plenty of the stuff that goes on to those moments where I felt welcome in the house and those other moments where this is the last place I want to be, sitting in my dinner table, in my house, in this family of mine. I don't want to be here. And actually, nobody wants to be here, but here we are. But you must transpose that into that which did not kill you makes you better. And we'll say this. There was no abuse. There was no physical thing. All there was a real confusion as opposed to how to express or how to explain what the hell was going on. And shame on all of us. The easiest thing to do was not say a thing. And shame on the parents who taught me how to not say a thing. But now it's my responsibility, ain't it? It's my responsibility to understand that and try to come to all of my kids. My oldest is 45. My youngest is 26. And I first apologize for everything I've done wrong. Hey, I'm so sorry about everything. And then just get into it and start saying, okay, so what's the truth about what's going on? Tell me more about this. That's the best I can do right now. And that's not seduction. That's literally saying, help me know more. Help me know more about this. Educate me, if you will, and come at me with anything you got.
Tom, I'm grateful to you for taking the time to talk to me.
Do I owe you $150 for these 50 minutes? I mean, honestly, I don't see any plaques on the wall of this studio anywhere. Don't you have a...
You don't see a bachelor's degree in American studies from UC Santa Cruz?
You're a banana slug, man.
Not to brag.
Pass, fail, no grades, please. My niece went to UC Santa Cruz.
Thank you. And thank you for your work. Your success is so well earned.
Thank you. I really enjoyed talking about this. This was great.
Tom Hanks, folks, what a guy. His newest movie is A Man Called Otto. You can catch it now in theaters. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is created from the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles, California. At my house in Los Angeles, we're waging all-out war on clothes moths. That means fumigation and filling contractor garbage bags with woolens and dry ice that I bought at the dry ice store and then closing them up. And then the dry ice turns into CO2 vapor, and then it kills the little mothies. Sorry if you're a moth fan. I wish moths all the best outside my house, as long as they're not eating my clothes. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Our producers are Jesus Ambrosio and Richard Roby. Our production fellows at Maximum Fun are Tabitha Myers and Brianna Paz. We get help from Mara Davis. Our interstitial music is composed and provided to us by DJW, also known as Dan Wally. Our theme song is by the Go Team. It's called Huddle Formation. Thanks to them and to their label, Memphis Industries. You can find Bullseye on YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. We share all our interviews on social media there. You can also find them on our website at MaximumFun.org or in our podcast feed. And I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch. This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. sell without needing to code or design. Just bring your best ideas and Shopify will help you open up shop. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR.
The Indicator from Planet Money is a daily podcast that helps you make sense of what's happening in the economy. And video games are a growing slice of that economy, with billions of people around the world identifying as gamers. That's why we're dedicating a week-long series to the growing business of video games. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money podcast on NPR.